You're listening to EPN, the e-podcast network.
Welcome to Enterprise Radio, the signature show of EPN, the Entrepreneur Podcast Network, your channel for exclusive interviews with entrepreneurs, small business owners, and some of the world's top executives who share business strategies and insights that can all help you build your business, leading to your business success. And now, broadcasting from anywhere between Brazil, South America, to Los Angeles, California, it is your host, Eric Dye.
This is Eric Dye, and once again, welcome to Enterprise Radio, working in conjunction with the Legal Corner, a part of EPN, the Entrepreneur Podcast Network. Today, we are speaking with Neville Johnson, a founding partner of Johnson & Johnson, LLP. One of the most feared litigators in Hollywood, Mr. Johnson has wrangled more than $350 million for actors, writers, and other clients he contends with that were shortchanged their fair share of royalties and profits. He was named one of the top 100 power lawyers in entertainment law by The Hollywood Reporter. Certainly impressive, and looking forward to hearing from you today, and thanks for joining us here on Enterprise Radio.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Now, you're welcome, and so I know we've got a lot to talk about today, so let's get started. If you would, just to kind of kick things off, describe your job and why it is that someone would hire you. I know that might be a funny question, but love to hear your response.
We tend to represent the so-called little guy or talent in Hollywood. So commonly we go after movie studios saying, hey, you know, you promised me money on the back end. Where's the money? What do you mean there's no profits on this hit television show or movie? Or we have copyright infringement actions, or people steal ideas. It happens all the time, and it becomes a television show or a movie, and we say, hey, you ripped me off. Or we have fights amongst the producers, or a typical example is, I'm in business with you, and I'm going to go out and find the money, and then I find the money, I find the billionaire, and then you say, hey, we didn't have a deal, and you run off. So those are typical kinds of cases that we have, and we're seven lawyers here in Beverly Hills, California, and we are predominantly litigators, but we also do contract work as well across the spectrum.
How did you get your break in the industry, and what was the case that made your name?
Well, I always wanted to be a lawyer since I was a kid, 12 or so, and then when I was about 18, I was just nuts about rock and roll and music, and I figured out there'd be a way to combine the two, and there was. And so when it was in law school, I concentrated on all things related to copyright law and contract law, and was fortunate enough to get a job with a good firm where we were representing people like Fleetwood Mac members and the Beatles catalog. And from there, I went on to briefly become a public defender for a year, which was very interesting, not really what I wanted to do. And then I went back into music. But my first big break was about 5 years out of law school. I became the lawyer for Yoko Ono and spent several years doing that.
Nothing like combining two passions into one. That's pretty awesome there. Now, Michael Ellis, a writer-producer who credits include The Jerk and the sitcom Head of the Class, says about you, he's kind of the go-to guy if you feel you've been screwed by your agent, your studio, or your network. He's not afraid to take on the studios. What do you have to say about that comment?
Well, you know, the way it works in this town is that many, if not most, of the firms do not want to go against the studios because they want to pitch the studios on other projects or represent the studios. And if you fight one studio, then you get a reputation for, hey, maybe you're going to fight us again in the future. So they tend to eschew taking on the big boys. We, on the other hand, are not trying to represent the studios, and we're not trying to pitch them anything. And also, we will sometimes work on a contingency or partial contingency basis, which most law firms don't want to do. And so that makes us appealing to people who are in the position of wanting to challenge the studios. It's a tough road challenging the studios a lot of time, because if you're a working talent, actor, writer, producer, director, and you go after a studio, that the worry is that you're going to be blackballed for doing that, for being a troublemaker, et cetera. So we find a lot of our clients are people who are at the tail end of their career, or perhaps an estate, heirs of somebody, or otherwise have just said, you know what, I really don't care what's going to happen. This is outrageous what happened to me. And believe me, there's plenty of cases in this town to choose from.
And I can only imagine. You have successfully helped people such as the members of Mitch Ryder and the Detroit Wheels, actor Jack Klugman and TV producer Glenn Larson collect royalties that were being withheld, kind of similar to some of those instances that you mentioned earlier. Why are you so confident of taking on the studios on behalf of the artist?
Well, oftentimes we have had an audit done. Or we simply know from looking at the statements that have been received based on our knowledge of the industry overall that they are being shortchanged. And as each new technological advance comes forward in our society and culture, that's just another way for the studios or whomever, the business people, to try and figure out a way to cut that down, shave it down, not pay on it, whatever it may be. So, if you know, a lot of times we're talking seven figures or more even for people who have been shortchanged. We're involved in cases right now, for example, where we brought class actions against the studios for underpaying on home video. And here we're representing all the talent from before 1981, like Richard Pryor and Peter Sellers and Charles Bronson's estate and other people who were not getting a fair count on home video, which was the primary moneymaker for the studios the last 20 years. So in that case, we did a really good thing for everybody because individually it wouldn't have paid for any of these people to take on the studios, but we did, and we've so far completed or resolved two of the cases, and we've got four more to go.
Would you say that Hollywood accounting is a law unto itself?
I would say, well, you know, the famous line was Eddie Murphy 25 years ago in the lawsuit that Art Buchwald had brought, and he said, it's monkey points. Why is that? Because you scratch your arm, scratch yourself underneath your arm and laugh like a monkey because you're never going to get paid anything. So we have found that, let's put it this way, virtually every audit finds money. And the studios each year try and find more ways to not pay or pay less than they should. So it's just a given. The problem is that you want to take on a studio, it's going to cost you a lot of money ordinarily. So who's got the hundreds of thousands of dollars to fight that? Now, if you're a big actor, they may be much more accommodating because they want to do business with you in the future. But if you're at the not such a big person, but still entitled to royalties, it can be very daunting overall. But the answer, to come back to your question, is that, yeah, it's a law unto itself, and it's so competitive in this town for people to get jobs that a lot of times you just have to knuckle under and sign these very, very one-sided, egregious agreements. And some people hope there's going to be perhaps a renegotiation later on. But each time a studio gets sold, they want to figure out a way to squeeze the profit out of that to pay for it. And who's going to get squeezed ordinarily? Well, you know it's going to be the talent.
And certainly comforting to know that's people out there to protect those artists in all regards. Today we're joined by Neville Johnson, a founding partner of Johnson & Johnson LLP and named one of the top 100 power lawyers in entertainment law by the Hollywood Reporter here on Enterprise Radio, a part of the Entrepreneur Podcast Network. Don't forget you can follow the show on Twitter at ePodcast Network, and we're also streaming on demand 24/7. On TuneIn Radio and the TuneIn Radio app for your listening convenience. Now, Mr. Johnson, what is it that you love most about your job?
I like helping people, and I very much enjoy the intellectual aspects of it. And, it's an honor to be able to represent talented people and help them get from A to B, whatever A to B, whatever B may be. Intellectually, the law is always changing and business is always changing. And then I'm meeting interesting people, not only my clients, but oftentimes the people who I'm up against. And I'm an advocate for somebody. And, if you think about what lawyers do, they're they're advocates for their clients if they're negotiating a deal, or they're advocates for their clients if they're prosecuting a case or defending a case. And so it's an honorable profession, and it's been, you know, really interesting to learn how to become an effective advocate. In other words, to be a gentle person as much as possible at all times, notwithstanding the fact that we're on opposite sides for purposes of negotiation or in litigation, whatever it may be. So I just like I like going to work every day, and it's fun and it's interesting, and it can be potentially very lucrative. Basically it's just a joy.
Now, you're representing or have represented Sony employees who are suing the studio over the breach of privacy caused by the computer hack the company suffered in 2014. What is it about that case that attracted you to it?
Well, I have a reputation in privacy overall. I've won some notable cases where privacy was invaded. And privacy is just as important as any other right in our community. And it's been eroding over time with the increase of social media and all the rest of that stuff. But this was a particularly egregious case. I mean, how would you like it, or anybody in your audience, to have all of their private data available to the world? And that's what happened here. So, but and most people, there was an identity theft. There was some. And for some people, and for a lot of people, nothing happened whatsoever. But some people got totally hurt in the situation. And I can think of one case where the person, information went up that was inaccurate, and is now public, and that person can't get a job. And has been devastating to that person's career. So what it points out is that this was not the first, but perhaps the most notable of examples of how problematic it has become in our society today for the protection of data. I mean, look, it's happening to Hillary Clinton with her own campaign. I mean, every day is a new WikiLeaks, et cetera. So American corporations, all corporations around the world, have to be super careful about whatever data they have. And I mentioned parenthetically as well, I've got another situation where they're holding up for ransom somebody's entire computer because of, you know, bad guys, presumably in Eastern Europe, who are saying, you pay me some money or you're never going to get your data back. And so that's a new thing that's been happening as well.
Certainly some frightful times in this era of technology and hacking. And they certainly got some interesting cases that you deal with on a regular basis. Unbelievable. What are the major changes that you've seen in the entertainment industry in the last 40 years that's impacted your work?
Well, I can tell you the biggest thing obvious to everybody out there in the world is the rise of digital. Go try and find a record store today. CDs are not even going to be around in 5 or 10 years, probably. There are no more stores that rent, no more Blockbusters. No, the home video is greatly, greatly diminished, and everything has gone to streaming or download. In fact, it was download in the music industry for, let's say, the past 6-7 years, and the last year is the rise of Pandora and Spotify, and it's all streaming now. So that has dramatically changed the dynamics of the music industry, as well as the economics of the music industry for talent. So, for example, in the music industry now, what they are saying for musicians is that the money you're going to make is going to come off of merchandising and touring. Well, what about traditionally where the money came from sound recordings and from music publishing revenues? And the answer is that that's greatly diminished because the royalty rates are nowhere near what the kind of money is that was being made before. The manager of the Eagles said not too long ago that it used to be a 50% split, 50% for touring and merchandising, and 50% for sound recordings and publishing, and now it's 90-10 in favor of live performances, et cetera. So that's probably the single biggest change in the business, which is great in the sense that if you're talent and you want to put out music or distribute your indie film, you have the ability to do so via the internet. What's your problem? Your problem is piracy. And what has also happened is that 99% of everything on the internet is pirated, is not paid for. So that, as a consequence, took the music business down from a $12 billion a year industry to maybe half that, although it's increasing back again, because the Google and companies like that are getting the advertising dollars, and the talent is not getting paid, and the record companies. So the record companies are pulling their hair out trying to figure out, how do we get paid overall? The biggest way to promote music these days is YouTube, and YouTube pays a pittance, and the record companies are very upset about that overall. So these are great changes that have happened in the business, and I presume there's going to be some equilibrium established at some point down the line. But our problem is that we have a sort of a gridlock in Washington on so many other issues, but including on issues like this. And you're fighting powerful industry groups when you're fighting the software makers and the internet service providers overall. So I'd say that's one of the biggest changes I've seen.
And that's a huge change without a question. Now, regarding the music industry, what do you think about people like Jay-Z, Beyonce, Usher, Chris Martin, Alicia Keys, and others who started Tidal to try to protect the rights of artists? And do you think this is a good model?
Well, they are certainly very intelligent people. They know what they're doing. But don't be too sold on their altruistic motivations for doing so. They're out there to make a profit just like everybody else. They're probably giving a better deal. In fact, they are giving a better deal to talent than you would otherwise get, say, from Spotify. But, are they going to save the industry? I don't think so. It's a little too competitive. But, you know, God bless them. And, you know, the more competition in the business, the better it's going to be for everybody. Hey, look what's happened, though. We used to have like 12 record companies in America. Now we're down to three major distributors overall. And I can tell you, the record companies overall, they're doing just fine. But what I'm hearing is that they're making their money on their catalog, and the new acts not so much overall, notwithstanding the Taylor Swifts who come along or the Adeles who absolutely blow the roof off.
Tell us about your songwriting alter ego, Trevor McShane.
All right, well, Trevor McShane is the stage name that I use. I've been making music since about 93, put out my first album in about 2000. I've got a few albums out and more coming out, and that's what I do for fun. I love writing songs, performing. I play guitar, I sing. All of my musicians are professional musicians, and we're just having a gas doing it, and we play out in Southern California, and I'm trying to get my music noticed by other people overall. My style of music, people say, who are you like? Well, I get Mark Knopfler, Eagles, Jimmy Buffett, Bob Dylan, Lou Reed, Leonard Cohen, typically. And so I call it folk, rock, country, pop. That's my style.
You gotta love it. Sounds like some good stuff right there. Now, what is it that compels you to write, and what do you get out of performing?
You know, I think everybody has or should have a creative outlet overall. I'm not the world's greatest guitar player, but I can get the ball over the plate, and I can create melodies with relative ease, and I love to write verse, which turns into songs more often than not. Some people want to watch ball games all the time. Some people want to work on automobiles, whatever their hobbies may be. I don't want to play board games. I don't want to do crossword puzzles, but I love to rhyme. And I just find it satisfying and a great diversion from, you know, the day-to-day toil of being in my business, which can have a lot of, you know, stress that comes with it. You know, I have sometimes there's a lot of anger that needs to be diffused from coming from the other side, or just the frustration of the business. So this is just simply a great way to relax overall.
Awesome. And tell us, lastly, why did you start your own publishing company, Cool Titles? You certainly do stay busy.
All right. About some time ago, I became interested in something called the Pyramid of Success, which is a philosophy that says success is peace of mind, which is a direct result of self-satisfaction and knowing you did your best to become the best you're capable of becoming. And who created that? A man named John Wooden. And who was he? The greatest coach in the history of athletics in the United States. From 1963 to 1975, his team, the UCLA Bruins in basketball, won the national championship every single year except for 2 years. He has a host of not only unequaled, but I call them unapproachable records, 7 years in a row, the national championship. So this he's an incredible man, not to mention an incredible coach. And I decided to write his biography, and I spent a long time doing that and interviewed nearly 200 people from his family, friends, ball players like Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and Bill Walton, historians. I went to Indiana where he was from, and I learned all about him because I was so impressed with his wonderful philosophy, poise, confidence, ability, skill, being focused, honesty, having faith. These are some of the ingredients of his pyramid of success. And so I wanted to own the copyright. So I learned about the book business, started a book company, put the book out. It became a bestseller. We're on the second edition now. And since then, I've put out probably 19 or 20 other books. My wife runs the company, and we put out fiction and nonfiction, and I find it a lot of fun and interesting. And I own the copyright.
Well, I got to tell you, Mr. Johnson, you've got it going on in every neck of the woods, and it has been such a pleasure to have had you today. Where can listeners get more information accordingly, and how can they best be in touch in any regard?
If you're interested in the law aspect of my business, go to jjllplalaw.com. That's the website. Or look up Johnson & Johnson in Beverly Hills or Neville Johnson. And if you're interested in the music, I'm at TrevorMcShane.com, and there's a bunch of videos of me, of Trevor McShane, up on YouTube that you can see, and you can buy stuff from iTunes, etc., and there'll be much more coming out.
Well, Mr. Johnson, it certainly has been our pleasure to have had you. Continued success, and hopefully we can get you back on down the track right here on Enterprise Radio.
Well, what a thrill, and so nice of you to have me. Thank you.
And you are more than welcome. The pleasure certainly has been ours. We have been speaking with Mr. Neville Johnson, a founding partner of Johnson & Johnson LLP, and named one of the top 100 power lawyers in entertainment law by The Hollywood Reporter. And for more information, visit jjllplaw.com as well as TrevorMcShane.com. And this is Eric Dine. You've been listening to Enterprise Radio, a part of EPN, the Entrepreneur Podcast Network. Pick up our iPhone or Android mobile app for your exclusive mobile listening convenience. And once again, we do thank you for tuning in.
Thanks again for listening to Enterprise Radio here on the Entrepreneur Podcast Network. To subscribe for future programming, simply visit epodcastnetwork.com.
This is the ePodcast Network.